Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
Ah, the fairy, the wondrous world of the fae, and indeed the magical scenarios that exist therein. Certainly we're delighted to actually welcome a fine soul who's actually got a key interest in both the fae, British folk, folk rock, folk metal, etc. She's got an upcoming novel that's going to be coming through in the very near future. She's a great creator of magic, etc. It's Alethea Lyons. How are you, Alethea?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. Great to connect with your good self. Now, Thea, just share with us, where exactly are we connecting with you today?
I am in Manchester in the UK.
Got it.
Right at the airport, for anyone who knows it.
So you see, we don't have to worry about time zones and whether you're actually sort of on the west coast of America or Canada and so on. You're one of our great British contributors. So that's always great.
Always easier.
And of course, Manchester, great land. Of course, home of Pep Guardiola's boys, amongst other things, who have got a whole range of other factors as well. But let's not go down the line of football at this stage. Let's talk more about your good self and, of course, your creativity and so on. Now, we've had a look at some of the fascinating worlds that you've actually put into place. The notion of tales of fantasy, folklore and fae, is this something that you've always had a fascination in? Is it something which, in essence, you've always felt that actually that whole notion of producing folklore and science fantasy and so on, is that deep rooted in your DNA?
Absolutely. I mean, it's something that originally I get from my parents. My parents are both fans of science fiction and fantasy. So I grew up watching a lot of that on TV. We had a lot of science fiction and fantasy books in the house. And they're both big folk music fans as well. So the ones that you can listen to when you're younger, we listen to. And then as I got older, because some of them are definitely not suitable for a younger audience.
Yeah, we can go with that. Now, obviously, there's been much debate over the years within fandom and continues to be so. I mean, despite the fact that every so often we think, well, surely, you know, China Miéville sorted this out. It's all forms of literature and so on. But the difference between science fiction, science fantasy, fantasy fiction, the whole genre with respect to that. So I'm going to actually put you on the spot here, Thea. Okay. How would you define science fantasy?
So for me, it's the blending of the two. And it's basically that you have elements from both. So there'll be some kind of futuristic element, whether that's through technology, whether it's through the type of society that it's in. And there'll be a fantasy element, which for me usually involves some kind of magic or non-human creatures as well. So the stuff that I'm writing, a lot of it's sort of near future for us. A lot of different technology, that's science fiction technology, cybernetics technology, things like that. But with that element of fae and magic coming into it as well.
It's one of our classic lines that I've used many a time with students over the years, that Arthur C. Clarke, of course, famous amongst other things for not only having his ashes in space, but also this whole notion of any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And clearly on that basis, you can draw a line to J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter and say, well, maybe that's science fiction as well. Is that one of those definitions that you'd also subscribe to?
Yes and no. I think certainly a lot of technology can have that appearance of magic, as he says, because you don't know how it's happening. And I think a lot of science fiction kind of gets away with, well, it's the future, it's aliens, it's whatever. And therefore, there's a technology we don't know about. We'll just kind of fluff it in the writing, which I have to admit to doing sometimes. So, but there, I think there is also just magic that is not technologically advanced, that is not dependent on the same rules of science.
I've just been second marking some creative writing submissions at the University of Lincoln, and it's interesting how the students that kind of have moved into really understanding this particular fantasy do actually acknowledge the importance of character, the importance of scene setting and so on. From your own perspective, is this something that you've always been producing? Because, I mean, clearly we're going to speak at length about The Hiding, which is due out in the spring of this year from that point of view. again, in terms of making those initial notions of long form fiction, and developing that, do you feel that you're more concerned about the characters or the world building, or is it a case of, well, you need to have both?
Definitely like to have both. I tend to start from one point or the other. So a lot of the time I have started with a character or a small group of characters that have a strong personality in my head, basically. And then I start building up what their world is like around them, largely by just kind of sticking them in it and seeing what happens. So when I'm getting ready to do a longer book, I tend to write some short stories based on those characters and on that world, so I can really get a feel for how they'd react to things and what's going on around them.
Big year, as we said, this year for your good self, because not only on the 5th of March 2024 does The Hiding emerge, we've also got book 1.5, which is interesting, The Reawakening, emerging on the 3rd of September. Now, The Seer of York, again, these are stories set in a dark alternate version of York where magic and the secret police are feared in equal measure. I mean, I've got to ask the question, you're based in Manchester in Lancashire, what are you doing right about Yorkshire? Surely you should have set it in Lancashire.
Well, I actually grew up on the East Coast. I only moved over to Manchester when I went to university. So York and Yorkshire is where we spent like every summer holiday. We were in Yorkshire, up in Scarborough, in the Dales, in York. So it's very much kind of a home of my heart. But also the setting of the book needed somewhere with suitable age and political and religious background. And Manchester's just too new. So it was kind of York or Canterbury are the two obvious choices, and York's the one I know really well.
Indeed. Well, I mean, of course,
Also,
you've also,
got to stick with the North.
yeah. Which again, also, it's at the heart of that whole mantra that writers, you should write about what you know. And clearly, if you look at that, you're absolutely right. I mean, you mentioned obviously some of the coastal routines. You've got Robin Hood's Bay. You've got a rich tapestry of obviously Knaresborough, Shipton. You've got a whole stack of stuff which is actually there. So again, how much have you blended some of the mythological aspects that you grew up with some of your own creative theologian's input?
I tend to start with my own input and then go away and research it and kind of find out what's already out there that I can play with it. So you mentioned Shipton. There's a little bit in The Hiding that kind of refers back to Mother Shipton and that sort of way of seeing things. And in their alternate universe, of course, whether or not she was actually a witch and a seer and has that link to my seer. And I don't want to kind of give a spoiler, but to do with the antagonist, there were certain things that I wanted her to be. And so I then went away and did some research into some of the local folklore around what she is and some of the general British folklore around what she is.
And of course, there are those, certainly in the northern aspect, who say that Nostradamus, pah, Mother Shipton had all her predictions sorted out long before you ever actually sort of came up with the whole sort of bits and pieces. But never quite reached, I suppose, the global fame of Nostradamus, really, Mother Shipton. But having said that, I suppose the fact that Knaresborough was purchased by Paul Daniels to a certain extent, or at least her part, was maybe a certain bit of magic. That's another line entirely. And obviously, Paul Daniels is in a different dimension now as well. Let's move back to again this whole notion of the seer, which again is foretelling the future. Now, clearly we are using a device at present, which if Mother Shipton was seeing it, she'd be saying, witchcraft, wizardry, what's going on here? People communicating over miles and miles with sound and vision from that line. Do you feel that actually there is a kind of scientific rationale? I mean, there are lots of things that have been put forward to explain, for instance, ghosts, insofar as everything that's uttered at one stage always has an impression, it leaves an impression in the environment, and so on. And as many physicists would actually say, certainly cosmologists, everything is happening all at once, simultaneously, in the notion that it's just we have this concept, maybe for our own safety, to actually believe that time is linear as opposed to all compressed in so on and so forth. Are there any areas of those kind of, in a sense, hard science perceptives that have influenced or do influence your writing and input when you're talking about seers in general?
Absolutely. And Personally, I've always kind of liked the Douglas Adams view of it that comes up in one of the, I can't remember which one, but one of the latest books of Hitchhikers. And he's talking about a book of poetry that's been written and received all this acclaim. And the person who wrote it has to go back and redo it. And essentially, it never gets written because when they originally write it, they're copying the book from the future. So technically, nobody ever wrote it. It's just come into existence in this almost magical way, but within a science loop. And I quite like that idea that there are things that technically fit within the science loop of things, but don't necessarily make sense entirely from it. And I think certainly with what Harper's doing, there's obviously a large element of magic, and it's mostly based in that witchcraft side. But there is also the element of to what extent what she sees is something that she can change, or whether the future is something that's more locked and she can't do much about.
Harper, of course, is a witch and an archivist at the Minster, which is fine. And she has her own little team. You've got her foster sister, Grace, a vet, demon hunter, and goddaughter to the Archbishop. You also have Heresy, a deception demon or illusion spirit. Saqib, a forensic supernaturalist, and AJ, as opposed to AI, a techno witch. And of course, Fionn, I should say, who's mostly a cat. Were those characters that, in a sense, they have their roots, or have they derived from other experiences that you've had, or was it a case of, well, let's mix and match here, let's mix and match some of the authentic Christian-oriented work of the Minster and so on? We obviously goddaughter to the Archbishop, etc., with some of the more esoteric magical elements of the region.
There's a lot of it that, in terms of those relationships, and as you mentioned, the religious background, I wanted to show something that I see a lot in real life, but not as much in fiction. And I think, fortunately, globally, there's some division on this at the moment. But within my friend group, I have friends who have many different faiths, different cultural backgrounds, and there is nothing in that that stops us from going out and having fun together, working together, having interesting conversations about our religions and cultures. And I wanted that element to be in the hiding, that there is this group who, maybe on paper, don't start out as having a lot of things in common, but by the end, actually a very good friend coming into a family relationship almost.
Again, just the opening paragraph comes from the descriptor. Arcane archivist Harper is plagued by nightmares of grotesque creatures and bloody deaths. Her visions are becoming more frequent, more violent, and they're coming true. She is guilt-ridden when a man is killed after she had a visceral experience of his death and did nothing to prevent it. The unusual marking on his corpse, combined with his neatly excised vocal cords, sends a ripple of terror through York, and rumours of witchcraft abound. Not for the faint-hearted, or is it a case of it would fit into the young adult category? How would you actually pitch the actual text of The Hiding?
The main characters are in their mid-20s, so about 24 to 27 are in that range. It's not terribly gruesome to read. There's not a lot that's shown on screen, as it were, because I'm a complete wuss. I'm in a writer's group that is mostly horror writers, and I'm not quite sure what I'm doing there because I definitely write dark fantasy and not horror. So if you are a bit squeamish, you'll probably be fine. So I'd say if you, people in their upper teens would be able to read it certainly, because it doesn't go anywhere too dark, but it is creepy rather than gory.
I'm going to take a slight turn now and move into the land of Fairport Convention. Why Tamlin? We're about to hear it. So, would you like to tell us why Fairport Convention and why Tamlin in particular with respect to musical tastes?
And this is another one of those things that has been with me since I was very young. It's one of my parents' favourite albums. We listened to a lot of that kind of 1970s folk rock movement with the old LPs and everything that they still had. So I can still hear that bit of the crackle in my brain when I listen to it as well. But I just love this particular story. And I think, especially for young women and girls, there's something really wonderful about that actually in this story. you have a princess who goes out and she does her own thing, and she tells her father off, and she tells off the queen, and she's the one who actually rescues the knight. And it has a really great tune.
Halloween and the fairy fall bright, those that were
You're listening to Author of the Week with Alethea Lyons on the Midweek Drive for Siren Radio. We've just been listening to one classic track from that point of view. Thea, let's stick with music. Some authors, when we ask them, do they have a particular soundtrack, have a whole range of things that they will say, yes, I can't possibly write without actually listening to this in the background. Some people will actually turn around and say they need to have music without lyrics, because if there are lyrics actually there, that'll take them off on another trail and they don't want to actually sort of be cross-influenced by that. Some people prefer absolute silence. Do you actually have a soundtrack to listen to? Is there something which you feel inspires you, or do you prefer to actually lock yourself away in the garret and say, I'm being creative?
I like to have some background music. I stop hearing it after a little while, but it helps keep out all the other little sounds, especially when my mom brain wants to kick in, because as soon as I hear the toddler, even if I know he's with my husband, that kind of pulls me out of what I'm doing. So having some background noise kind of drowns out the potential things that could interrupt. And it depends how I feel on a given day. Sometimes it's absolutely nothing to do with what I'm writing, and I'll stick on like some pop rock or something that's not in the slightest atmospheric. But a lot of the time I like to listen to stuff that does kind of have the same vibes. So for The Hiding, quite a lot of instrumental creepy music, or things that has kind of that more ethereal vibe, like some Blackmoor's Night, Lorena McKennitt, Outgrabe, things like that.
Okay, let's talk not just the writing process, but the actual genre itself. And we touched on this at the start. One of the key areas that is certainly an element of both science fiction, horror, and fantasy is huge fandom support. And also, arguably, it's only crime fiction or crime writing that effectively can run conventions successfully, post-pandemic, obviously, and pre-pandemic, in an area where writers can actually meet their readers and indeed build a whole range of connections within that. Is that an area you started beginning to explore? Do we find you turning up at the various sort of book events, etc.? Is it something which you say, well, it's all part and parcel of the whole promotional package, and my agent will be most concerned if I didn't actually sort of work on these sort of side of things? Or is it a case of, well, I'll do events and conventions, but it'll be under suffrage?
No, I would love to do events and conventions and things. I think it would be really great to meet people who have actually read it, because most of the people I know who've read it now, of course, are people that have read it because they know me, as opposed to people who are reading it and have no idea who I am before that. So I think it would be really, really awesome to be able to talk to people and have them ask me questions about it and just enjoy sharing something I love with someone else who liked it.
Did the characters come alive for you? Were they real living beings? Because again, it's go back to Charles Dickens, who in many ways used to have keen conversations with his creations and so on, so we're told. And there are a whole range of other factors. Were there sort of areas where you thought, actually, yeah, Harper is real. You know, I can appreciate the whole thing. And were there moments when you were writing the text where you thought, or she was sort of saying, no, I wouldn't do this. It wouldn't actually sort of be in my vernacular.
Oh, I'm very much of the school of writing of I start out knowing roughly what's going to happen, and then my characters will go, actually, we want to do this instead. And sometimes that's great, and other times I'm thinking, I don't want you to do that, but they're going to go do it anyway because that's what they think is the best thing. They're very definitely alive as their own voices. Something my husband kind of has to put up with as well, because sometimes we'll be out and doing stuff and it will just come into my head of, oh, this character would react like this to the situation, or they would want to say this at this point about it. And he just kind of has to then listen while I tell him all of that.
Makes perfect sense, really. Let's progress on to your own influences. I mean, we said there are a whole range of writers that are actually out producing stuff. I mean, are you more of an Anne McCaffrey fan? Are you an Ursula K. Le Guin fan? Are you neither of the above? Are there other sort of writers that you'd actually say, you know, I'll go down the line of, you know, Sam Stone, whomever?
Definitely. And I mean, it's one of those. I have a lot of different writers that I like to read. Obviously, most writers do try to read fairly extensively if we can. And obviously coming up from that background from childhood, you have all of your real classics of fantasy, like you said, Ursula Le Guin, Tolkien, McCaffrey. I think certainly for the Hiding kind of vibes, going into sort of the Neil Gaiman side where you've got that urban fantasy, and that's where I first kind of started playing with urban fantasy was after reading Neverwhere. So that's kind of been a big influence as well, because there's a lot of folklore elements in his storytelling too.
So, how much, if any, would you say of Dore is in Harper, and how much of Harper would be in Dore?
Oh, I think that's always tough with characters because there's always overlap between things, but I think Harper does stand alone as her own person. She'd certainly want to say that she's still alone as her own person. And if she didn't say it, Grace would, because Grace is really bossy and outspoken, so.
Let's just quickly move on to Neil Gaiman. I mean, if you're familiar with the thing, would you Neverwhere or Sandman? Which one would you prefer?
I mean, Neverwhere I read first, and I've read obviously the whole thing because you can read Neverwhere. Reading Sandman, you have to kind of put aside a few years. I have not read the whole lot. I've read some of it, and I've seen what's on TV as well, which actually seemed pretty good to me in comparison to the comics that we've got. But there is something lovely about just sitting down with a proper paperback that has no picture or very few pictures and just letting the visuals take you in your own head.
And looking to that, I mean, again, this is something which certainly is a kind of post-Kindle question. How do you prefer your readers to actually consume your text? Purchase the paperback, make it sure there's a physical copy in hands, read it online, or is it a case of neither? I mean, or do you have a feeling a bit like certain film directors who say, if you want to see my movie, you should see it on the big screen?
No, I think people should, however they're most comfortable with it, whether that's a physical book, whether it's online or on Kindle. If I ever get lucky enough to have it as an audiobook, that would be fantastic. For me personally, as a reader, I like to have a paperback. I just prefer having that texture and that bit away from the screen because, obviously, as a writer, I'm spending so much of my time looking at a screen, and then I go to my day job and I'm looking at a screen. So I like having that separation, and I find it easier to slip into that kind of mental space where I stop seeing the words and I'm just seeing the story. But that's different for everyone.
We spoke about how we have Book 1.5, Reawakening, coming out in September 2024. Is that more of a novella, or is it again a case of, well, it's not quite a trilogy, but then again it is, and we won't go into Book 2, The Somnia, until March 2025?
So I mentioned before about kind of conceptualizing characters and worlds and writing short stories in order to get to know them. Reawakening is actually at least half of them are those short stories. So I actually wrote The Somnia first. And before when I was getting ready to write that, I was writing these stories that kind of took place in the lead up to it of what the characters were doing. And then after writing The Somnia, I was like, oh, this is a book too. So then I went back and wrote The Hiding. So Reawakening is, I think it's 13 or 14 short stories that are set in the aftermath of The Hiding, and then also starting to introduce the plot of The Somnia.
How do you relax, Thea? How do you cope with respect to life? Because you said you've got a young child, you've obviously got a husband as well. You've got from that point, you've got your writing, you've got your commitment from that point of view. Are there any moments that you tend to use to switch off or unwind, or is that a case of, frankly, there are only 168 hours in the week, and I use every one of them?
It's a bit of both, and actually writing has always been my way of having that switch off and unwind time. It's time when I can just sit, I can be in my own head, it's quiet time and creative time. And until relatively recently, that was what I used writing for. I wasn't seeking publication or to do anything with the stories per se. It was just something that helped me relax. And other than that, also, obviously, music is a big thing. So when my son allows it, without trying to snatch it out of my hands, I get out the violin or the mandolin and have a play there. And honestly, sometimes my husband and I just kind of go, we're going to flop on the couch and play a game or watch some telly.
There you go. Exactly. So, in the 21st century world of multimedia and approaches with respect to that, you've already alluded to Notion that hopefully an audiobook might be in the offing, fingers crossed, etc., which would be good. What would you actually see the world of the Seer of York crossing over into different areas? Could there be role-playing games? I mean, I could certainly see ways in which you could have a sort of multi-level role-playing game developing from that. The inevitable TV series slash movie, etc. These things which you kind of think, yeah, options are open, or will it be a case of no, I want to keep them in the sacred words of print?
No, I am happy for stories to be told in any media. I've played quite a few role-playing games. I've done some writing with a friend for running games as well. So things like World of Darkness, Dungeons and Dragons, of course, some more science fiction type ones, stuff like Shadowrun. So I think it would be really cool to have someone actually going, I'm going to take this world and I'm going to add my own character and see what happens to it. And there's quite a bit of TV influence in The Hiding as well. I grew up watching stuff like Buffy and Charmed, and those kind of influences are definitely coming in.
Which is next real question, insofar as if we could actually weave that magical wand and you could actually have a team up between any of your particular characters, let's say the three sisters from Charmed, or indeed Buffy, Xander, anybody, and Harper, etc. Who would you actually choose? Or would you go even further back? Would you actually say, I'd like to put them in a world where they met Arthur Dent and Zaphod Beeblebrox?
I think it would be they'd have a good gel, as you were saying, with someone like Buffy or with Three Sisters in Charmed. They'd have a lot in common, but I think it would be interesting just to shove them into something where it was entirely different, which to a certain extent I do with some friends. We do a weekly thing where basically we just bring our characters along to an event of something happening and see what they do. And so you've got characters from all sorts of different weird backgrounds suddenly going into a scenario that's nothing to do with what their book normally would be. And it's a really interesting character development. Like, what would they do if suddenly faced with, 500 years ago and there's no technology, or they're in a place that normally wouldn't have any magic, and how are they going to deal with that?
We talked about clearly your love and fondness for the mythologies and aspects of Yorkshire. I mean, Britain is one of those lands which is replete with magic in all sorts of ways. I mean, Manchester's not too far away from Wales, and there's a whole stack of material there. In fact, one of our regular correspondents, Marie Powell, has written extensively about the 12th, 13th century, where she kind of mixes real life history with magic and so on and so forth. Are there any other areas of the British Isles, or indeed Europe, or indeed the world, that you've kind of been fascinated by, that you think, actually, I'd quite like to, I don't know, maybe check out Canada and find out more about their kind of mythological legends and so on, or maybe the native Australians and so on? Or is it a case of, no, I'm staying with Yorkshire?
No, I've got quite an extensive collection of books that are on my shelf over here that are mythologies and folklores of different places. So I do like to kind of collect and read about different ones. I'm half British and half American, so it's always interesting to see kind of the different things from North America as well. And my mother used to teach American history, so she has quite a lot of resources on the pre-European history, the Native American history that have always been fascinating to read growing up. I think one of the ones I'm particularly interested in, and I wish I could go, would be to go over to somewhere like Japan and go into the East, where there's still a lot of infrastructure even around the folklore and just the most fascinating creatures and stories. I think it would be brilliant to go over and see some of that firsthand.
Of course, we haven't mentioned that little land that's, I think, to the east of you, called Ireland, which has got a fair number of texts as well from that point of view. Is it something in the human psyche that actually likes to feel that there are greater forces, things, in the words of the great bard, that more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in our poor philosophy, or is it just a case of, well, that's the way the mind functions?
For me, there's definitely that spiritual element. And I think whether you're talking about folklore and fae, or whether you're talking about religion, there's a need within people to believe that there's something greater than we are, that there is an afterlife, that there is a magic to the world, something that can give hope and beauty in that way, even when we have really dark times around us. And I think some of that really shows up when you're looking at more of that global folklore, because you start to see common themes that are running through the stories from cultures that probably shouldn't have intersected or would only have had very minor points in common, but actually the basis of the stories can be very similar.
Well, of course, the Russian formalist Vladimir Prop with Morphology of the Folktale back in the, I think, early 20s came up with the notion that there were only four or five key stories that were there which had a commonality. And you could also take it further in terms of Jung and his Jungian archetypes, which tend to emerge whether you're dealing with folk collective experiences from from America, from Australia, and so on. So again, it's certainly something which opens up things. So, as we said, a very busy year for yourself for 2024 and indeed 2025. What are the things you're most looking forward to?
I think some of it's quite simple. I think it's just going to be really amazing to see something that I wrote on a shelf, and I'm hoping to get it into
hopefully
some of
be taken down from the shelf and actually purchased. Well, so that's always good as well, unless it's on a library,
nice.
Which, yes, it'll be going from there.
So I think that's just going to be really great. It's one of those things that you think of as a child when you're going to the library every weekend and coming out with this massive stack of books, and you're writing stories of, could that one day be one of my books? And you think, no, because it just kind of seems so far-fetched and so much work, and it's not practical. And, you know, a lot of things when they're teaching you as children is you're not going to go into something that's an art thing. You need to go and do something where you're going to be able to earn money and things like that. So you just kind of go, well, I do it for fun, but it's never going to be something. So like 6-year-old me just thinks it's so brilliant that there's going to be a book that's out there with my name on it and people are actually reading, which is also somewhat terrifying.
And commenting on and possibly actually having ownership in certain instances of your characters as well. It's one of the aspects. I'm sure you're familiar with the notion of death of the author. Once the actual text has been released into the ether, then yep, That's it, really. It's all gone and done and dusted. Coming to it to a close to a certain extent, in the business of publishing, clearly there are things that we've been doing today, actually the interview, the media interview and so on. There's obviously the role of the agent and so on within that. What advice would you give to other young writers who are kind of thinking, oh, I wish I could actually start beginning to develop in the same way that Alethea Lyons is, etc. What would be your kind of top tips for people who are actually sort of saying, okay, I'd like to actually follow through this? Or would it just be a case of, well, if you're a writer, write?
Be definitely the last, because you just need to do it. And I think if you're in writing in order to be famous or to make money or something like that, then you're going to be disappointed. But if you're in it because you have a story that you want to tell and you enjoy writing that story, then that will help get you through the difficulties of the publishing industry, because it is difficult to put yourself out there. It's difficult to ask people to read your work. It's very difficult to send it to agents and presses who are going to turn around and say no, or we want you to change things in it. So it has to be something you really love. And I'd say also try and find other like-minded people. It is an absolute saving grace to have a group of people who are writing friends, who we read each other's work. And I've learned so much from them in terms of writing craft as well, both from them commenting on my work and saying, you know, this doesn't make sense, or have you considered something else? And also reading their work and thinking critically about what they've written helps me think critically about what I've written and how I can improve it. Plus, just you need the support. It's just good to have people who, A, go, what you've written is really good, stop thinking it's awful, but also can kind of be there through the ups and downs of the publishing industry for you.
So find your tribe would also be a
phrase,
perhaps. How can people actually follow the magical world of yourself? Is it simply a case of go to AletheaLyons.com, or would you actually point you into another area entirely?
Well, I've got a link tree, which is basically a website that links to everything else. So it links to my website, it links to my newsletter, which is monthly, and to my social media. I'm most active on Twitter. So if people want to follow me on Twitter, it's
or even
at...
X, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, we'll not go into that. It's at Alethea R. Lyons. And my Linktree address is pretty short, so I'll give you that because that has all the pre-orders and everything on it as well. So it's just linktr.ee and then / Alethea R. Lyons.
Well, that's brought us around to two final questions, which are pretty critical because we tend to use them on a standard basis. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today? Has it been okay for you?
Yeah, it's been fantastic. It's my first one, so thank you very much.
Well, we would not have known, Theo. We would not have known at all. So the next critical question is, can we look forward to connecting with you again in the near future? Will you be kind enough to return?
I would absolutely love to. Thank you.
Dancing to the feel of the drum, leave this world behind. We'll have a drink and toast to ourselves under a violet moon. Tudor rose with her hair in curls will make you turn and stare. Try to steal a kiss at the bridge under a violet moon. Your hands and your glasses too. We will dance the whole night through. We're going back to a time we knew under a
Was George Bernard Shaw who once said, "Whom the gods would destroy, they first say they have potential." That is one of those wonderful words that actually we frequently hear when it comes to human beings. Do we fulfill our potential? Do we reach our full potential? Well, apparently 3/4 of adults say they've yet to reach their full potential in the workplace, which could be seen as some good ways to progress forward with New Year's resolutions and so on. And to actually talk us through some of the steps that you can take to begin to start realizing your potential, we're delighted to welcome one of the UK's most experienced career coaches, Joanne Mallon. How are you, Joanne?
I'm very well, Alex.
Excellent. Now, Joanne, clearly you are fulfilling your potential. You're doing wonderful things, helping other human beings and so on. But how do other people actually work through that? And this particular survey in terms of skills for life in particular, how does it kind of relate to ways in which we can feel more fulfilled as human beings?
Well, I mean, I think it's actually quite exciting to see that all these people are recognizing that they maybe haven't completely fulfilled their potential, but they're on the way and they've got something in the future to look forward to. Because the other side of this is, if everybody was saying, yes, they've already fulfilled their potential, then and where do you go? Are you saying then that you've peaked and it's all downhill from there? I think many of us, myself included, you always feel like you're just getting warmed up and there's always something new to learn, something new to find out about. So this is kind of the really key part of the whole Skills for Life campaign and the website is we're encouraging people to learn, even if you haven't been at school in a long time. And maybe you're somebody like me who absolutely hated school, but still loved learning, because that is the way to start and just fulfill your potential, maybe move into a new job, maybe gain some skills, just feel that you're being active and moving forward in your life rather than staying stagnant and always doing the same thing.
Over 2/3 of those surveyed are looking to set themselves a career-related goal in 2024. And again, 71%, so again, over 2/3 of adults are keen to make more time for learning. And the buzz phrase a few years ago used to be, of course, lifelong learning. Do you feel as though this is very much at the heart of that whole notion that, as you've just said, Joanne, we don't really stop having that insatiable curiosity to find out what's over the next horizon?
Well, it's a good thing to be curious, isn't it, Alex? I think if you get to the point where you think you know everything about everything, that's kind of a difficult place to be. I think in terms of the world of work, change in the workplace is much more common than it was in previous generations. I think that the job for life scenario where you leave school and then you do the same job until you retire, I think that that's increasingly rare nowadays, partly because those jobs don't exist, but also partly because we recognize that we change as people. And whatever you want to do at 25 is not necessarily the same as what you want to do at 45. But also, as well as that, there's the fact that the world is changing. Technology is changing incredibly rapidly. So even if you were staying doing the same job, how you do that job, how you communicate, and the skills that you need to have, that will always be changing. So I think the world of work is now and is going to continue to be a world of change and a world in which we have to be open to learning new things. But this is why we've put on the Skills for Life website lots and lots of resources that we hope will help people. Free training, careers assessments, you could speak to a careers advisor. There's a lot out there, and it deliberately is covering different areas of life. So everything from numeracy skills, literacy skills. If you wanted to learn about digital marketing, engineering, maybe even green skills, which is such a big thing and, so increasingly important right now. It's all there for you. But I think one thing that we've recognized through the surveys that were done around this campaign is that people feel like they haven't got much time for training. I think they assume that learning is going to take a huge chunk out of their already busy day. But the truth is, we all spend far too much time scrolling on our phones, the dreaded doom scrolling that always makes you feel a bit rotten at the end of it. So I think with our Time to Learn challenge, we really would encourage people to make a commitment that maybe you take 10 minutes, half an hour, an evening, whatever it might be, that you're already probably spending on your phone, but put that into learning something that's actually going to do you some good in the future. Because doom scrolling doesn't really do anybody any good, does it?
Absolutely. And indeed, the phone obviously going off in all sorts of ways, basically, from that perspective. The classic line, of course, that in terms of doom scrolling that stays with me, certainly 1.6 hours was the average response that people actually spend dealing with social media, which is about 3.5 weeks a year. So surely if you put that to learning, it's going to be a virtuous solution for everybody.
Absolutely. I mean, to be honest, I bet it's more than that. You know what it's like if somebody's asking in a survey? People always kind of underestimate to make themselves sound a bit better. I'll tell you one thing I've started doing, Alex, is I've started charging my phone outside my bedroom because I had a really bad habit of picking it up first thing and just scrolling through the nonsense. And that is no way to start your day. So now I put it somewhere else and I get up and I learn a language. I do a bit of yoga in the morning. Suddenly I have all this time, and it's not that you have any more time because everybody's got the same 24 hours in a day, but it's just assessing where is your time going that's not actually serving you. I think that's the thing about doom scrolling. It's a draining thing to do. You don't feel good at the end of it. Whereas learning and exploring your own possibility, that's a really empowering, uplifting thing to do. And that's aside from the fact that you might actually physically know about something that you didn't know about before when you started.
Skillsforlife.campaign.gov.uk. Is that the best place to go to find out further details?
Yes, I mean, it's super easy to find because all you need to do is just Google Skills for Life. The next time you pick up your phone to go on social media, maybe instead Google Skills for Life. And just see what speaks to you on the web. So there's tons of resources there, tons of free resources, and see what sort of takes your eye and draws you in, and then your path will start to unfold from there. I don't think you need to plan out everything you're going to do, but just take a look at Skills for Life. But more importantly, make your commitment that your time to learn starts now.
Joanne Mallon, one of our most experienced career coaches. Huge thanks. And keep on keeping on, Joanne.
Same to you, Alex. Thank you.